Hey, welcome back, friends.
Woo!
This is Mark Berry.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Brant.
Hey!
Brant's here too, and Shane the intern. And
well, ex-intern, but we're here.
Full-time Shane is what we call him now.
FT Shane.
And the curls. The final installment, Trav Talk, DB History.
Third time's the charm, bro.
We're in it. I mean, obviously, we could do about 50 of these things.
Oh,
but,
gosh.
You know, he gave us three. And this one got pretty heavy. It was some crazy times. We're fully franchising at this point, opening up shops left and right. Brand new headquarters built with a roasting facility. And there's a fire. And what happens? And then Dane Boersma tragically getting sick with ALS, passing away. Some interesting times for Dutch. This is a big part of the history.
We refer to it as the dark days.
The really, dark days, yes.
Because it was such a journey through all the pain and all that stuff. And so, but check it out. Last installment of the history of Dutch Bros Coffee. Hope you guys enjoy it.
We had this big situation. Paul Layton, who's our green bean buyer broker today, still buys all of our coffee. He got into a nasty divorce. And life happens. And this divorce really cleaned his clock. I don't know how they settled it. I don't know what went on with it. But at the time, his business was called Coffee Corner. And they had retail outlets, cafes. That's what more what they were called, more so than coffee houses. It was a cafe. And they served like breakfast and lunch items. And they were in Fifth Street Public Market. And they had varietals from all over the world. And so he had hundreds of wholesale accounts. That trendy, cool thing that seemed like tempting, right, to me, it was like wholesale accounts everywhere. His wife ended up taking over the whole business, and Paul was out. And so we started to deal with his wife, and she instantly raised our prices. And she not only raised our prices, she raised everybody's prices, top to bottom. And all of a sudden, they were dropping like flies. And over 6 months, the retail parts of the business started to crumble and implode, and you could see it. People weren't happy. It was about money, and it was clear as day. And so we made a tough decision. We said, you know what? We're going to have to transition from her because she's not cool to deal with, and she's missing orders. This isn't sustainable. The writing is on the wall. Change is going to be necessary. We're in Taqueria one day. And we're having this conversation over tequila and Modelo Special Lights and some great Mexican food and some unbelievable service. And Jared came in to visit with us from Portland. And it was like, dude, good to see you, you know, yeah. And we're rapping and talking. And we were talking about maybe, you know, we should open this coffee house. Our customers always wanted a coffee house. And we're like, dude, we've got this opportunity, but it's a lot of money, and I don't know if we should do it. And we're beating it up, we're kicking it around, and some of our best decisions were made in Taqueria. And Jared came in and he goes, well, I don't know what you guys are waiting for. Why don't you just do it? What are you afraid of? Just go. It's going to be rad. It's going to be unbelievable. You guys could make that place cool. And what started with that idea came our roaster. We should start roasting our own coffee. So we decided to do another one of those cool LLCs, and we called it Boersma Bros. We went down, had the documents drawn up. We thought, hell, if we're providing the coffee like Paul has always provided to us at the same cost, we'll do it for what Paul used to sell it for, and we'll roast the coffee. We'll have ultimate control of the product, and everything will be seamless, and we'll keep everything rocking and rolling with Marty because he doesn't have a pot to piss in. He borrows everything that he's got, and he wants more money all the time. We'll do our own thing. We'll reinvest in Boersma Bros and sell it back to Dutch Bros. So Jared and I took 17 grand in cash in a suitcase, and we got on the plane to go to Sandpoint, Idaho to go buy our first coffee roaster. I mean, it was like, shit, man. We put it up in the storage bin above your seat in the commercial airliner, and we were on our way. Sandpoint, Idaho. I mean, that's like 1995. So I'm at that stage of my life. I'm 24, you're 25. And we're going up to go visit with Diedrich Coffee Roasters, Steve Diedrich, to go buy this coffee roaster and have him train us how to roast coffee because it's got to be easy. I mean, hell, if Paul can do it, we could do it. So we got up to Sandpoint, found a nice bar to cruise into. We had several pints, I think, to make sure that we were really polished for the next day. And we met Steve Diedrich, and he showed us some of the stuff that he knew how to do. We didn't spend a hell of a lot of time with us. And I'm like, yep, we're ready, let's go. Jared's like, whoa, man, I think we need to learn a lot more. I'm like, dude, we'll figure this shit out later. Don't even sweat it. So we brought the roaster home. We dissolved our account, I think, sometime later. But previous to dissolving the account, we set that roaster up in the new coffee house on 6th and D. We inked our deal. It took 6 to 8 months, I think, to get the whole thing remodeled. It was a Myrtlewood factory with pegboard on the walls. So we went in, we did a lot of the work ourselves. We chipped all the stucco off the brick wall that's exposed now. It was just over the top nuts. And we got that thing dialed in. We put the roaster in, started experimenting. I'll never forget the first roast that I did. I'm roasting the coffee and I'm following the manual. You gotta season the drum and there's a timer on it and a temperature gauge, and I'm trying to keep up with what I gotta do with the manual, and all of a sudden the temperature's at like 375. And there's an alarm that goes off and I'm like, what the hell is that, right? It's like, and I'm like, oh shit, I'm behind in the manual, right? And I'm looking, and so I get to this place and it's like, yeah, when that alarm goes off, press this button, it'll reset and then you're good. And I'm like, okay. So I kind of try to go back, and then and all of a sudden the temperature's like 425. And I hear the coffee just cracking. And I'm looking in the glass and I'm like, oh my gosh. And I'm tripping like, you know, how do I know when the right time is to dump it? And is it all gonna be cool? And before I knew it, it wasn't even 30 seconds, 40 seconds later, it's at 475, approaching 500 degrees, and the alarm starts sounding, and the smoke is bellowing out, and I'm like, oh my God, I don't know if it's on fire. They said, don't open the thing. If it's on fire, it'll blow shit up. I'm thinking that I'm gonna burn the whole damn place down that night. And it got to 500 degrees, I dumped it. It was black and oily. I mean, it was charcoal. I burnt the shit out of it. Smoke everywhere in the building. Fortunately, no fire. And that's how the drum got seasoned. And back then, it was 20 pounds loaded into a hopper by hand. You weighed it, and you put it in the hopper, and you got about 17 pounds out. And you lost moisture content. We had a little log. And Jared and I were the coffee roasters. And I think at that time we had maybe a half a dozen locations, and Marty was totally cool. He was like, yeah, whatever, man. I don't have the money, I get it, no problem. It's all good as long as it's the same price as what you guys were doing, but I need a little bit more money. And I'm like, dude, we're at $100 a day. I mean, we can't just keep giving more money. The money's gotta go back into the company. Dude, you wanna grow with us? This doesn't work right. You know, it was never about the money for us. It was about how we could like provide a living and make a difference and do something extraordinary. And we weren't on the same page, and it became really apparent. And so kept having that conversation. So dude, what would you take to walk? If you could have your cake and eat it too, what would it look like? And where would you live? And how would it work? And what would you do? And we kept having those conversations. And then finally, when Marty came to us again and says, I have to have more money. We were like, dude, how about we write you a check? We'll give you a fat down payment and we'll give you that $1 million and you can go back to the East Coast where your family is and we'll figure it out. You carry the paper, we're gonna be cool. And he's like, really? We said, yeah. He goes, I'm in. And we were like, oh shit, it's for real now. And $1 million, I'll never forget, it was $12,000 payments a month. And it was at 7% interest. and we were only taking 100 a day. So we were paying him 12 grand a month to not be a part of it anymore. And in the midst of that, this other little thing happened before all of that transpired. I left this out, pretty critical. We decided with Borsma Bros, we would start to franchise the model. And with that franchise, we thought, you know, if we could connect with our employees, if we could connect with people that had like minds, if we could keep this thing rolling and provide opportunities, this could be an extraordinary way of living. And so Ty Sullivan, he was a mill worker. He worked his ass off. If you know anybody who works at the mill, I mean, it's intense. It's massive, physical, intense labor. And it's demanding, and you get paid well, but he had worked at the mill for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. He knew what hard work was. We shared some of the principles and values with work ethic, and he wanted to get into the coffee game, and so we talked about how we could do it, and we did a deal with Ty. He became our first franchise owner, and he was going to go over to the North Ashland exit. And when all that occurred, we brought it to Marty and Tammy, and they were pissed. Marty was pissed. Tammy was more pissed. And we're going, why is Tammy pissed? This doesn't make any sense. What? Why does she give a shit if we're going to be in Ashland? I mean, they're over on Biddle Road and McAndrews and Riverside. What's the issue with her? Like, she's butthurt over this. And she's making Marty more pissed, and he has no reason to be pissed either, really. I'm thinking, well, he's pissed because he's not part of the money on it. Well, it turned out Marty was pissed, and it was because Tammy had fueled his fire, and she had already made plans to go open the Human Bean on the north exit right next door to the site that Ty had picked out. And nobody knew that they had done the negotiations on the sites when they inked the deals. It just happened to be in the same time frame. So all of a sudden we had turmoil, we had drama, and Ty, we're like, dude, good luck. I mean, who would have known, right? And so Ty was kind of at odds with Tammy, and Tammy had done a partnership with a guy, Dan Hawkins, Hawk Oil, and they had all these old gas stations, old money in Medford, and there was all these dynamics that were taking shape. We're not gonna focus on the drama. We're gonna get through it. It's all gonna work out. And that first step became buying Marty out and paying him way too much money. And then we focused on how we could do our game and focused on what we could control. We knew that we couldn't control any of that other stuff. And quite honestly, I mean, we were in a place that was kind of like a euphoric place for us. We never had any idea that it would be profitable like it was. We had no idea that we got to enjoy this lifestyle, and we were having fun trying to make commercials that would go on the radio. And I mean, it was like, this is unbelievable. And Dane, as a business partner, as a mentor, as my best friend, as my brother, I had such admiration for him because of how he was a father and how he was a husband. And I got to watch him on an intimate level walk through all these different aspects of the company. I mean, Dana was working over at the Riverside shop, pulling shots. Brant, at his really young age of what, 12? Was like making shaved ice behind the counter. I mean, they were engaged, and it was cool, and it was fun, and it was family. And Dane wrote the first franchise agreement. And that's what we used with Ty. I wrote the first operations manual. And it was the system for execution on how we did what we did. And we didn't know a damn thing about any of it, but we were learning. And it was just taking risk, and it was keep going forward. And it was that little philosophy, that the four-step process of know your specific outcome, take massive action to get it, ask yourself if it's working, change it until it does, and you just kept doing it, man. And maybe there was blessing and gifts that I had with risk tolerance. You know, I mean, at the young age of 12, I was entering scores in football games on an Apple II computer, and we were creating our own point spreads and betting on football games. You know, I mean, I just thought it was a right-on way of life. But I think there were lessons along the course of the way for me at a pretty young age. Seeing my old man buy and sell cars and flip it to make money, I did that same thing. I ended up being in a place where I didn't have to have that hardcore summer job. I did that too, but I had excess money for play because of some of those efforts. And I think as the quest and the journey began to take shape 4 or 5 years into the business, we started to complement each other. His strengths and skills, my strengths and skills, our weaknesses, we offset each other. We used to go into the cities to try and figure out how to get approvals for certain things. And if it didn't work well for Dane, I went in. And if it didn't work well for me, he went in. And if it didn't work well for us, we sent somebody else in. But we never gave up on trying to get the answer, the green light, the yes. It was never take no, there's always a way. And we tried to figure out ways to get people to come up with, how could we get them to say what we wanted done? And it was through questions. It was wild. It was this crazy, magical crusade. So in 96, the coffee house was open. We're roasting our coffee. We're distributing it everywhere. Carly's working in the company. And Carly, my sister, she's honest as the day is long. She's like, this coffee sucks. It gives me bird tongue. And I'd be like, well, we'd go back, try and make it taste like the stuff was, and we couldn't get it right. It took us forever. And she was hardcore. We'd go have a meeting. I'll never forget, we'd have a manager meeting. And Carly, I'm not doing that shit. That's dumb. And I'd be like, what in the hell? I mean, we get into a battle over stuff. But she had standards and she had expectations of how things should be. And she wasn't afraid to have that confrontation or that conflict. It was always that we were sparring, and Dane laughed. He just laughed his ass off at everything and thought it was funny. Just go with the flow. Jared probably worked more shifts with Dane than I did. Carly worked more shifts with Dane than I did. I liked working alone. I mean, if you work with Dane, it was like straight stick 'em. It was the biggest train wreck mess ever, man, and he didn't give a damn. It didn't bother him whatsoever, man. And I'd just be right. I'd be like, this is nuts. But Jared working with Dane, he'd have it all polished up. He'd have the bottles just cherried out, everything nice and clean and neat. It was like magic. It was like clockwork. And I'm like, well, that's unbelievable how you can do that, because I can't do it. It's crazy. And I wasn't the cleanest dude, but I was a hell of a lot more clean than him. So we continue to press. The drive-through model continued to evolve. We had family members that went and ran them. I had a cousin who took the model over to Klamath Falls. I had a nephew who's still up in Roseburg today, Clayton Reinhart, my sister's son. He went up there and started the concept up there. And we kept with that four-step process and kept on growing and learning. And 99, I think Brian came on, and it was like, we're going to go, man. We're going to really go conquer. And Brian had a background at Great Pacific Trading Company. He was a commodities broker. He had bank relationships. He was wearing that suit and tie and shit and looking all slickstered out. It was cool. I dabbled in commodities a little bit. I thought, you know, what about green coffee? Let's see how that shit works. What if we throw some coin at it? We'll gamble on it a little bit. I got burned like 40 grand, man, one time. That was the end of that. And Dane was like, dude, just go. Do it. We'll figure it out. Your education is way more better than a college education. You're getting real life experience in business. He's like, yeah, you handle the remodel. Let's see how it all unfolds. I was empowered. And then when Brian came on, he was like, you guys are the action guys. You go. You go get the sites, you do whatever it takes. I'll be the stabilizer, I'll be the glue, I'll be here. I'll make sure that when I'm downtown, the customers know that you can always see Dane downtown. And I'm like, okay. We did. We went hard. We went out, we drove the streets. We set up meetings. I just took massive action. I'd go to a meeting and I'd introduce Brian as my brother-in-law. And they'd go, wow. This dude's got a lawyer. That's how they took it. A lot of them, it was a trip because Brian was all professional. And here I was just letting it roll. And it worked. We got a lot of deals inked, a lot of spots done. We kept with that growth pattern. And before you knew it, I guess what, 2004 had rolled around and we decided to move to our new warehouse out on Upper River Road. It was 14 acres. It was an old bulb farm. It was 20,000 square feet of space. We were getting ready for the biggest growth trajectory we'd ever faced. We had tons of sites in the hopper, and we had tons of people who wanted to take the concept to the moon. And we were selling franchises to people who were passionate. Chris Stewart was a Hellgate boat driver. He took the concept to Springfield. Aaron Eastman, he ran the grocery stores here in town at the time. They were shopping carts or market of choice, I think they converted to. And he quit his job and took the concept to Albany. And we just kept on growing with people that we thought could kill it. Back in those early days, Mike was working in the area as an electrician, and his wife, Leanne, she worked in the company. She was an aspiring teacher, and she's killing it in that space today. I was trying to sell them a franchise back then. I mean, don't be a teacher. Be a Dutch Bros franchise owner. You're going to have way better life. Mike could look at me like he does right now, like, you're nuts, dude. So when that warehouse finally got completed and we'd made it Dutch, our version of Dutch, which was kind of like freewheel it, it was so bitching. We were ecstatic. I remember we had our first manager meeting out there, and I bought Nike shoes that were like canvas blue, royal blue, and you could get your name engraved on the back. And I had a pair of every one of them made. And I think they were, I don't know what they said. Do you remember, Brent? They said Mafia on them or Dutch Mafia or D-Bros. Yeah, D-Bros. And those D-Bros shoes, man, I gave to all the managers. It's just like, this is a gift from me to you. You can wear them in your shops, man. I just thought they were sick. And life was good, man, 2004. Things were happening. Things were buttoned up. Still had that $12,000 stroke every month that we were dealing with. And it was a mountain, but we kept on chipping. Had we got financial advice back then, we probably would have never done it. Yeah, give them $1 million, dude. You guys take, you know, $3,000 a month, it's gonna be great. You know, I mean, it just wouldn't have happened. There was a huge amount of risk. There was a willingness to do whatever it took with work ethic. And there was luck. And, you know, I've heard many people say this, and I believe it. Preparation and opportunity, when they meet, that's what luck is. And we were always prepped to go. And when the opportunity came, we took it. We seized it. And we kept with that, and I think we got lucky a lot. And so, acclimating into that new building, I think we were only there maybe a few months. I brought on another one of my great friends who I trusted at the time, Al DeCourcy, to be a director of operations. He had taken the concept down to Arizona, Flagstaff specifically, with Ty's brother, ironically, and they opened Wicked Arizona Coffee. It's still down there. And they fought like cats and dogs. He moved home. I gave him an opportunity to come within our organization to try and take this franchise model to a whole nother level. And shortly after we made that move, there was a fire. It was August 8th. It was 108 degrees. And we were swimming up in Brian's pool, just up the street. Our homes were close proximity to the roasting plant, our offices that we were so proud of. We had more inventory on the floor, more equipment than we could ever imagine having. We were ready to go into this growth trajectory. We had franchised over in Bend. We had all these different people that were depending on us, and this dumpster fire started, and the dumpster was next to the building, and it was plastic. The previous warehouse that we had a steel dumpster, and we had it next to the building. We never thought twice of having the plastic dumpster next to the building. Didn't think there was anything wrong with it. We don't know today still if it started because of combustion or a cigarette or if it was arson. my gut says it was combustion. Because of all the remodeling and the paint and all the stuff, I know that there was stuff thrown into that dumpster, and on that hot day, I think it ignited. And it melted against the wall. Dan had a Camaro. We had five cars in there. I had a K5 Blazer, a 64 Impala. We had our stock vans and our waste truck, all these rad cars and stuff. And that dumpster fire, when it started, my mom came bombing up Brian's driveway. She's like, hey, there's a fire. It's a dumpster fire. Get in the car. We just ran straight over to the car, got in the car. I mean, it was board shorts, and that was it. No keys, nothing. Got down there, and I thought, dude, this isn't that big a deal. Call the fire department. They're on their way. Everything's going to be cool. They're going to come put it out. It's going to be minimal. It sucks, but it's going to work out. 20 minutes later, they showed up, and it had caught, man. Dane had tires off of his Camaro on the other side of the wall. Didn't even think about it. And it just started raging, man. And there was no stopping it. We watched it burn to the ground. The whole damn thing. We stood around that place, man, tripping out. And it was like, holy shit, we got to start making game plans now. We had no backup plan. Paul Layton, man, first call. I talked to him. I said, hey, man, we had a catastrophic fire, dude. It's burning as we speak. I got to have coffee for our franchisees. Can you help us? He got on the phone with Boyd's Coffee up the street in Portland. And they roasted their coffee for us at cost. Home Valley Bank opened their doors up, gave us office space. We had hardly anything. We were really homeless. The goal, though, right out of the chute was get out of the fucking fire. Do not get caught in the fire. I had people coming up that had been through fires, and they're like, man, you might want to get on some medication like antidepressants or something that's heavy. That motivated me to like want to not do it even more. I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing that. That's fucking stupid. That's just how I felt, right? There's no way that we're getting caught in this thing. And we kept on, and we kept persevering. Our vendors bent over their backs. They did whatever they could do to help us throughout. And truly, we had our taste of what it was like from being a victim and having community outpour and help. And that was a game changer in our organization. It served us. That big catastrophic fire maybe was a great lesson for us. It made us more resilient. It helped us to understand what community was all about on such a magnitude that we experience many times today in so many different ways. And I think it resonates. That had a ripple effect that has continued to flow throughout our organization from 2004 on. And at that time, it was right when Dane's speech was starting to slur. It was an interesting place. And I thought it was stress. I'm like, dude, he's probably not comfortable with how hard I'm going, flexing our business, taking on these franchisees. And I wanted him to have inner peace. We had owned the large majority of the Medford shops. Ty had a few. And we had to make some quick decisions. And so we chose that we'd sell those Medford shops to Ty. We'd take some money and put that over to Marty and try and get out of that pickle. And I had a conversation with Marty, and we paid him off early and got a discounted rate to do it. I think he was also nervous that maybe we wouldn't be able to afford it after a fire like we had, so he was more than happy to take what he could. We had the property that we had there on Upper River Road. It was burnt to a crisp. There wasn't a stitch on it that was worth anything. And I did a big deal with Charlie Morrison, who was like a local auctioneer nut that had more property than anybody in the town. And I always enjoyed conversing with Charlie. I learned so much in just some of the negotiations that I was doing with Charlie, but he also had a big heart, and he was willing to help us in a time of need. So we swapped that 14 acres, the property over on Ringette where Dairy Queen and we sit on the corner, in exchange for the 5 acres, roughly 5 acres over at Agnes. And we already had our location over there, and that's where we were going to build our new corporate headquarters that never happened. So 2 years went by with us being homeless. We found spaces, places in town. We had this place above the coffee house that had a stairwell. We called it the War Room. and we made do with what we had. We just did it, you know, and we finally moved into an office over on 7th Street that was too small, but it worked. And then we found this place. And I mean, we were combing around, looking everywhere, and this place was going through a bankruptcy. And we figured out a way to get a long-term lease inked here. And I think it was about 2008, I guess. We drove our stake in the ground and we moved into this building, and it was giant for us. Hell, I think there was only, what, a dozen of us or so. And look at how many we've got today. You know, the story kept unfolding and life happens. And many people think, like, you know, looking in from the outside, it all just happens and it's easy. But the fact of the matter, the tension was always there. The struggle was always real, and it is still today. And little did I know that Dane would be diagnosed with ALS. Little did we know what that would look like to go through as a family. And we did. And for me, it was the dark years of Dutch Bros, 2004 to 2007 or 8. Man, it was rough. And I just was like, I don't give a damn. I'll do it in spite. We're going to make this shit work. We're not going to get drugged down. And through family support, through people that were key in the organization as pillars, Brian and Christine and Brant, Tim and Jonah and Sandy, you know, being in the place that she was, caring for Dane day in and day out. I mean, it was my folks. There were so many friends outside of our family that helped the community. I mean, it was really this thing that served us as life lessons in personal and professional life. And getting through that to the point where Dane could pass and be free was some of the greatest lessons I've ever learned in my life. And really leaning and understanding that there's more of a bigger plan and a bigger picture than what I'm aware of. And I just have to trust that it's there and have faith, because you don't get the privilege to understand why these things take place. It doesn't make sense. You can't quantify. We can't wrap our minds around them. We only are able to use a certain percentage of our minds anyway. So, you know, a greater understanding that things happen and we get to do what we can with what we have where we are. That's it. And then time passes and we're on to another thing. And those storms that come, they just end up going away. And then there's more coming. And that's the problems and challenges that we encounter, and we've lived it. It's been epic and euphoric, and it's been downright dirty and nasty and ugly. And I wouldn't want it any other way, I guess, because I think that those things have served in the growth of the company and made us stronger collectively as a unit. And that franchise model, it was a really great thing for us at that time. It served our organization. In 2008, I had the opportunity to sit down with Dane before he passed, and he had lost his communication. I'd go in and I'd tell him how much I loved him. And then I told him that we were at a pivotal place. We had franchised the model, we'd sold it, and we had experienced a lot of success. But our culture, I felt, was being compromised. And I knew I had to work on me, and I knew we had to work on us to make it stronger and better and dig down deep. That Tony Robbins seminar that we were going to go to in 2004 when the fire hit and we were never able to attend, I was going to go. His smile said a million words. And so we went down as a group, Brian, Brant, Levi, myself, Tim, and we just went through the whole damn thing. We ended up doing the UPW thing, immersing ourselves into it, walked on fire. We ended up doing life mastery and wealth mastery and date with destiny and all this stupid crazy shit that you never could imagine yourself doing in a million years. And it was uncomfortable as hell, but we did it all, man. And we went to this one thing that was called business mastery, and we sat down and we had this intimate conversation with us as a group, and we said, man, what business are we really in? And for years, I thought, we're in the coffee business, duh. Hello. Like, we roast it and shit. We serve it. People buy it. I mean, this isn't rocket science. And it was like, nah, wait a minute. We're in the relationship business. And that little twist with a decision to only grow from within, I think catapulted us to a level that we would never understand as it is today. And the culture became the priority and the sole focus and the relationships that we created. And so the road over the last 10 years from 2008 to now, yes, it's had its bumps. Yes, we've gotten bruised. We've experienced some unbelievable results too. And we have to celebrate those victories, those milestones better. I think that's important for us. We forget, we get so caught up into the problems and the challenges, we forgot what we already conquered. Hopefully I'm relevant while I'm here. I may not be by the time I get to 70. I hope that Dutch Bros goes on and makes an impact that is unprecedented in the way to do business in the United States of America. But it starts with doing it right in the moment with where we are. I love you.